From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Games. The NBA has reserved a throne-like place in the 2009 finals for King James, but will LeBron accept or abdicate? Ahead on Only a Game, Clevelanders nervously eye Game 6 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Also, the hockey teams from Cities of Steel and Motor prepare for this year's Stanley Cup Finals, and a new biography of George Steinbrenner. Also ahead, collegiate lumberjacking comes to New Hampshire.
I mean, it's so much fun because I'm a small person, so for me, I feel very strong when I'm holding an axe. Nobody's going to mess with me.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. After the Los Angeles Lakers overwhelmed the Denver Nuggets last night in Game 6 of the Western Conference Finals, Denver coach George Karl called Los Angeles the best team in the NBA. The 119-92 score suggests that Coach Karl may be right, as does the fact that the Lakers won the series 4-2. The Orlando Magic host the Cleveland Cavaliers tonight in Game 6 of the Eastern Conference Finals, the series that will determine which of those two teams will try to disprove Coach Karl in the NBA Finals. Cleveland trails 3-2 after winning at home Thursday night to keep the series and the dreams of their weary fans alive. From member station WCPN in Cleveland, Eric Wellman reports.
To get an idea how good the Cavs are this year, consider this. They've lost only 2 games at home during the regular season, and they clinched their division earlier and by a wider margin than any team in NBA history.
They broke virtually every franchise record in virtually every category.
Mary Schmidt-Boyer covers the Cavs for the Plain Dealer newspaper.
Every day, every game, some other record or milestone seemed to fall. It was quite an amazing thing to cover.
Once the playoffs got underway, Cleveland swept the first 2 rounds, winning all 8 games by double figures, another NBA record. But the Orlando Magic brazenly jumped out to a 3-1 series lead. On Thursday, Cleveland was faced with a must-win situation. But if Cavs fans were dejected because their dream team was on the brink of elimination, you wouldn't have known it outside of Quicken Loans Arena Thursday night before Game 5.
Go Cavs! Woo!
Nor would you have known it inside of the arena. Barry Mannion traveled all the way from Los Angeles, not to watch the Cavs, but to see their superstar, LeBron James, who was named the NBA's most valuable player this season.
You get a couple of moments in your life to witness something special, and I think seeing LeBron in Game 5 here in Cleveland is the equivalent of seeing Jordan in the early 90s in Chicago, and those chances come by maybe once, twice in a lifetime.
Cleveland came out strong, taking a 22-point lead midway through the first quarter. But Orlando battled back to tie the game and eventually pull ahead before the Cavs put the game away in the fourth quarter by a final score of 112-102. Cleveland still needs to win 2 more games if it's to advance to the NBA Finals. Given Cleveland's dominance all season, it begs the question, why are the Cavs struggling so mightily against a team that they were expected to handily beat? I posed that question to the Plain Dealer's Mary Schmidt-Boyer outside of Cleveland's locker room after the game.
The Cavs' base defense that they have been practicing for 4 years has to do with shrinking the floor, which means you pack the paint and dare people to shoot from the outside. Sadly, Orlando is only too happy to do that.
In other words, the Magic are hitting 3-pointers.
Oh, my God. It just feels like it's like 4 or 5 guys on the Magic. Every time the ball leaves their hand, it looks like it's going through the net.
A few blocks from the arena, Lisa McGovern was sharing drinks with a friend and trying to stay optimistic.
You know, the Cavs being underdogs right now, that we generally think that that's going to be something to push them forward. Yes, Cleveland sport teams like to be underdogs.
In fact, it could be argued that Cleveland sports teams are steadfastly refusing to relinquish their underdog status. No major sports team in the city has won a championship since the Browns did it in 1964. Talk to anyone in Cleveland, and they'd tell you that this is supposed to be the year the drought ends, and the Cavs are supposed to be the team to do it. Austin Briggs has been a fan all his life, and this season he decided to take his devotion to the next level. On the side of his black car, white letters spell the word witness, which has become shorthand for LeBron's greatness. Fans outside of the arena were taking turns getting their picture taken in front of the vehicle. Briggs says he never anticipated the response that he would get.
Oh, it's been ridiculous. I mean, one time we saw a girl actually backed into a fire hydrant, looking in her mirror at us and stuff. So we've seen some goofy things, people breaking their necks to take a look at the car.
The Cavaliers' incredible season has also inspired several fans to write songs about the team. Mike Bruckman is a local musician whose song, On Top of the World, has been picked up by many Cleveland radio stations, and his accompanying music video has become a hit on YouTube.
First MVP, number 23, and only 24, and you're beginning to believe. What I see is what you teach. It's a philosophy of camaraderie built on modesty, and I got to preach it. Maybe if LeBron James do it, so can I. We both from small towns, Northeast Ohio. He brought class back fast in his copper style. But if you're gonna make it the first, you got.
This song was written purely from passion and inspiration that I've extracted by following the chemistry of this Cleveland Cavaliers team. We have been through so much despair. You know, Cleveland is the butt of a lot of jokes, and it really only takes one person to change all that, and we happen to have that special person in LeBron right now. So I'm already inspired far beyond what happens in the NBA, but bringing a championship here would just be, I'll tell you, it would make for a great summer, at the very least.
But before the Cavs can even think about playing in the NBA Finals, they would need to win tonight in Orlando and Game 7 in Cleveland. Only 8 basketball teams have ever overcome a 3-1 series deficit. Speaking on TNT after Thursday night's win, LeBron James says they're going to need a repeat performance.
We got to play the same way we played today. We got to play gritty. We got to get the ball up the court, play fast. We got to attack. We got to do everything in our will to try to take that game away from them and bring it back here.
If there's any team that can overcome long odds, Cleveland fans agree it's the 2009 Cavaliers, led by number 23, LeBron James. For Only a Game, I'm Eric Wellman in Cleveland.
It's plain the Red Wings of Detroit have all been playing great. It's odd to think a penguin living anywhere could skate. And yet the Pittsburgh Penguins, though they may look sort of funny, may beat the Red Wings of Detroit. It's probably even money. Or maybe it isn't. Joining me now is Only a Game's highly esteemed harbinger of hard-hitting hockey, Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Hello, Helene.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. The Penguins duo of Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin have been clicking quite well of late. Must the Red Wings shut down these talented line mates to have any chance in this series? Or really, more to the point, can they shut them down?
That's the better question, can they? And the interesting thing is, too, is that last year in the finals when these two teams met, Malkin was kind of spooked. You could tell he was just not used to the intensity and the hitting and everything else that went along with it. But he really hasn't shown any nerves in the playoffs so far. And there's this old hockey philosophy that you have to lose in the finals before you can win, or you have to, you know, go through a long playoff run to learn what it takes. And I really think that has some merit in the Penguins' case. I really think that they learn, you know, the day-to-day commitment and the relentless nature of the playoffs, and I think that's going to benefit them this time.
Who else should we be paying attention to on the Pittsburgh roster?
Well, I think Bill Guerin is kind of a wild card in that, you know, he's an older guy, or in hockey terms, he's old. He's 38. He's made some very valuable contributions, and he could kind of be the wild card kind of guy who, you know, if he succeeds, it's going to be tough for Detroit to shut him down.
The Penguins have faced bankruptcy, possible relocation as well over the past few decades. Should this team go on to win the 2009 Stanley Cup, how far will that go towards securing the team's place in Pittsburgh?
It's really an amazing story if you think about it. You know, a few years ago, there was a lot of speculation the Penguins were going to be sold and moved to Hamilton, and there was the certainty that they needed a new arena, and actually a new arena is being built across the street from the current one. It won't open this October, but it's scheduled to open in October of 2010, I gather. It's just an incredible story. Mario Lemieux has put a lot of effort and his own money into, you know, keeping that team there. It's a great story. It's a civic story of people stepping up and corporations stepping up and just fans saying, you know what, we want this team here. Obviously, the Penguins' continued success is only going to strengthen them down the road. And if the Penguins can brand themselves as a winner, that's going to be a huge achievement for them.
The league moved the start date of these Stanley Cup finals from Friday, June 5th, back to today. That wasn't announced until Thursday. Now Detroit General Manager Ken Holland is complaining about his team having one less day of rest than the Penguins have had. Are these complaints well-founded?
They originally sent out an announcement saying that if there aren't sweeps in the conference finals, then the Stanley Cup finals will start June 5th. And that would have meant a possibility of 9 days off. And you don't want to do that. That's a momentum killer. The NHL kind of makes it up as it goes along. You know, I understand you don't want to wait 9 days between the end of the conference finals and your showcase event, the Stanley Cup finals. But it's also not fair to do it this quickly. But NBC wanted the back-to-back Saturday-Sunday, so the NHL kowtowed completely to NBC, which isn't even paying them a rights fee.
The Red Wings are really banged up. To what extent does the team's recent Stanley Cup success offset their injuries?
The Red Wings skated Friday morning, and Lidstrom was there. But Jonathan Erickson, who had an appendectomy a few days ago, wasn't there. And, you know, that's funny because you figure hockey players are so tough, they're going to be out there no matter what.
And no, they usually have their appendectomies on the bench and then go right back in, don't they?
Exactly, yeah, without anesthesia, yeah. So, and there had even been some speculation that he might play, but I think sanity ruled there. At least he wasn't out there Friday morning. But Datsyuk, Pavel Datsyuk, is also a key figure for the Red Wings, and he was practicing Friday morning, but in a very limited amount. They may try and throw him in there, I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, Detroit is a little banged up, and Pittsburgh's youth and relative freshness could play a factor, at least in the first couple games of the series.
Helene, as you pointed out, it was the Penguins and the Red Wings in the Stanley Cup Finals last year as well. Is that sort of continuity good for the NHL?
It's interesting because the storylines are there, and also you've got Marian Hossa, who last year played for the Penguins. Now he's playing for the Red Wings, so that's a great storyline. You've got the idea of, okay, Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin watch the Red Wings lift the cup, and you know, what did they learn from seeing that? You know, it's been 25 years since the last time the same two teams met in the finals 2 years in a row, the Islanders and Edmonton being those teams. But, you know, the Red Wings earned it, and so did Pittsburgh. You know, Pittsburgh had a tremendous turnaround the middle of the season. They fired their coach. They brought in Dan Bylsma. Detroit went through a season where they had some problems defensively. Both of those teams earned their way here, and there really shouldn't be any quarrel. These teams deserve to be here.
All right. We gave you a break last October when we didn't ask you for Stanley Cup finalists and
oh,
a winner at that point. But, you know, it's time. We may not get back to you again before this has been decided. So who hoists the cup this year?
You know, I'm still tempted to say the Red Wings, but seeing how beaten up they are, I wouldn't be surprised if the Penguins actually do it.
Helene Elliott covers pro hockey for the LA Times, and she puts the shine on Lord Stanley's chalice, as far as we're concerned. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you.
Want to see him climb the glass, start a little something with the fans. Want to see a hockey fight, a little Donnybrook, a little brouhaha. If our team should score tonight, we all can yell hurrah.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Where but France? Next month, 196 prisoners will participate in the first penal version of the Tour de France. The temporarily unincarcerated will be accompanied by 124 guards, and the rules for the event will differ somewhat from the rules of the tour upon which it has been modeled. The prisoners will be riding in a pack, but no breakaway sprints will be allowed, which would seem to be sensible. The prisoners' tour will cover 1,400 miles and take riders through 17 towns, each of which has a prison, perhaps in case anybody misbehaves along the route. Said one of the prisoners, "It'll be kind of an escape for us." That one's probably a guy the guards should keep an eye on, eh? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Bare Knuckles biography of the boss. But first, a week and a half ago, the Toronto Blue Jays, picked by most prognosticators to finish fourth in the American League East, were in first place. An unlikely collection of young pitchers had lined up behind ace Roy Halladay to help the Jays beat up on teams in the AL Central and the AL West. a circumstance which had not surprised Jays manager Cito Gaston.
No, not at all. I mean, why go to spring training? Why do all those things if you don't try to come out and win? And my guys have done a great job. Pitchers have pitched well. Guys have played as a team. We've got some big hits, different guys every night, and that's how you win ballgames.
Gaston, who managed the Jays to championships twice in his first term at the helm between 1989 and 1997, went so far as to say that he was happy his team wasn't playing in a less competitive division.
This is what it's all about. I mean, you look back and you can say, hey, you know what, we played in the best division in baseball. And whether you win it or not, it's just great competition, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
The Jays players with whom I spoke last week before a game at Fenway Park in Boston were similarly upbeat. Why wouldn't they have been? They were in first place. In fact, the only person who seemed skeptical about that circumstance was veteran baseball writer Mike Retzy, who covers the team for the Toronto Sun. He maintained that excellent performances by Brian Tallett and the rest of an inexperienced pitching staff couldn't have been anticipated, and acknowledged that the team's quick start had baffled him.
Nobody expected them to be doing as well as they're doing right now. It's a bit of a smoke and mirrors game with Brian Tallett, who pitched well last night, but he came out of the bullpen, and then they got three rookies in the rotation as well. So it is a bit of smoke and mirrors.
Since Mike Retzy offered that assessment, the smoke has cleared and the mirrors have cracked. Over the last 10 days, the Jays have lost twice to Boston, three times to Atlanta, and three times to Baltimore, so Mike Retzy is no doubt gloating quietly in the Toronto press box. And Cito Gaston? Well, I wonder in retrospect if maybe he saw this coming too, because when we spoke in Boston last week, he got a little twinkle in his eye when he told me about some of the jobs he'd had in the Blue Jays organization between his two stints as a manager. He seemed to particularly relish one particular assignment.
I was still part of the organization even when I wasn't managing. Assistant to the president, it was a pretty good gig. You know, you come out once a week in spring training, playing a lot of golf tournaments, and it was a pretty good job.
And if he were still assistant to the president, who could even consider blaming him when the team, previously leading baseball's most competitive division, headed south in a hurry? It would be easy to conclude that George Steinbrenner has been the most destructive owner a Major League Baseball team has ever had, except that his teams have so often won. It should be obvious to anyone that George Steinbrenner has always been petty, vindictive, and cruel, except that he has so often been kind and charitable. In George, the poor little rich boy who built the Yankee empire, Peter Golenbach takes on the task of telling the complicated story of the boss. The author joins me now from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Peter, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's my pleasure.
The subtitle of your book credits George Steinbrenner with building the Yankee empire, which may be a little misleading since the Yankees had flourished during various eras before Mr. Steinbrenner became involved with the team, but review for us the circumstances of the team that he bought in 1973.
Sure, it could have been rebuilding the Yankee empire, but I thought that was a little clunky. CBS owned the Yankees from 1965 to the winter of 1973 when Bill Paley, the owner of CBS, decided he didn't want the team anymore. Michael Burke, who was like an adopted son to Paley, was given the opportunity to buy it for $10 million. Paley had paid $14 million for it, and he thought that $10 million was a fair price considering that the Yankees hadn't done all that well. So Mike Burke decided that he needed people to invest with him. And the very first person to contact Burke about buying the Yankees was this Cleveland shipbuilder by the name of George Steinbrenner. And Steinbrenner had a lot of wealthy friends as well. And sight unseen, without doing any research at all, Michael Burke agreed to take George Steinbrenner on as a co-owner of the Yankees. I interviewed Burke and I asked him, you know, why did you leave? And he said something about 2 feet fitting uncomfortably in one small shoe.
Besides pouring a great deal of money into the team, what else did George Steinbrenner do to help create a winner?
There were actually two periods of Yankee success. And the first period was the Bronx Zoo period, 1976 to 1978. And the other period was the Joe Torre period, beginning in 1996. Prior to each of those periods, George Steinbrenner had been suspended from baseball for 2 years. Now, what does that mean? Well, Steinbrenner hated rookies. He didn't trust them. He didn't want them. And so he would always trade away the most promising prospects. He could not do that prior to the Bronx Zoo years because he was suspended. He had wanted to trade Ron Guidry, tried to do it twice. Flash forward to the 90s. George Steinbrenner got involved in the Howie Spira mess. He had paid $40,000 to a disreputable fellow for information about one of his players, Dave Winfield. And the commissioner suspended him from baseball for the 2 years. And during those 2 years, he was unable to trade Bernie Williams, Andy Pettit, Mariano Rivera, Jorge Posada, and a kid shortstop by the name of Derek Jeter. Prior to his suspension, he had wanted or talked about trading at least two or three of them.
Lots of baseball fans will remember that George Steinbrenner hired and fired Billy Martin multiple times. A few of them may be aware of some of the details of that relationship. Tell us about those.
George Steinbrenner was convinced that he was smarter when it came to managing than Billy was. And so every day he would send him notes. Billy, so-and-so should take batting practice. You should move so-and-so from the second spot to the eighth spot. And I know this because he showed me the notes. Billy showed me the notes. I mean, it's hysterical if it didn't make Billy so crazy. And he did this with every single one of his managers. And that included Joe Torre, of course. The difference was Torre knew how to handle George Steinbrenner.
I was surprised, all of this information notwithstanding, though, to learn that at least during his last two shifts with the Yankees, Martin was drinking during the afternoon, showing up drunk at night games, and sometimes leaving games to go to bars between innings, that sort of thing. How did you find out about that sort of thing?
He didn't hide it very much. I mean, Billy's alcoholism became worse and worse with each of his, you know, periods with the Yankees. And every time Billy would say to me, this time George has changed. This time he's going to be different. This time we're going to be friends. Well, you know, George and Billy were never friends. It was always the same relationship. And it didn't matter the first time, the third time, the fifth time. The criticisms never abated. The pressure never abated. And as Billy got older and the alcoholism took more of a toll, it was just harder and harder for Billy to cope.
Perhaps the low point of George Steinbrenner's tenure as owner of the Yankees came when he heard a stadium full of fans chanting, Steinbrenner sucks. What were the circumstances leading to that occasion?
George always wanted to be the guy the fans loved the most. He wanted to be known as the man responsible for the success of the Yankees. And that's not easy to do when you've got people like Billy Martin, when you've got people like Reggie Jackson or Dave Winfield or, you know, whatever stars he had. So they reached a point where Reggie Jackson's contract ran out. And Reggie clearly was the most popular member of the Yankees and not George. And I do believe that that was one of the reasons he decided that Reggie was over the hill, that he couldn't be productive anymore. And so he let him go and he went to the California Angels. The next year, in April, he came back, Reggie came back, and hit a home run. I believe it was the first game of that season. And that's when, as he was circling the bases, the Yankee fans started to chant, Steinbrenner sucks, Steinbrenner sucks. And they were chanting it for quite a long while. And the funny thing is that after the game, he came into the clubhouse absolutely furious, only to find the ball players chuckling at him, which made him even more furious.
In the 1990s, George Steinbrenner became a figure of fun, as unlikely as that may seem, when a character representing him was written into the TV show Seinfeld. At one point, one of the program's main characters, George Costanza, is trying to get fired from his position with the Yankees so that he can get a better job with the Mets. And Costanza pulls Babe Ruth's jersey from a trophy case. He puts it on, and he spills strawberry juice all over it. And then boss Steinbrenner calls him in for a meeting. Let's listen to that.
Wanted to see me, sir? I heard about what happened at the meeting this morning.
Yes, I already packed up my desk, sir, so I can be out of here in an hour.
And I have to tell you, it's exactly what this organization needed. If we want to look to the future, we've got to tear down the past. Babe Ruth was nothing more than a fat old man with little girl legs. And here's something I just found out recently. He wasn't really a sultan. Huh? What do you make of that?
I mean, this is a guy who would fire anybody at the drop of the hat. And whatever Costanza would do, the poor guy could not get himself fired. It was genius. It was hysterically funny. And I also believe that because this Steinbrenner character was on Seinfeld, fans took a much kinder view of him.
You go into some detail toward the end of the book of all of the good that George Steinbrenner has done. Tell us a little bit about that.
George is so revered in Tampa that they are naming a high school after him, the George M. Steinbrenner High School. Every year he has this fabulous banquet for high school coaches and high school athletes. He started an organization for the sons and daughters of firemen and policemen who were injured on the job to make sure that their kids could get scholarships to college, and he's done that in Tampa and in New York. You talk to people in Tampa about the good deeds, how many colleges he has given money to for facilities, for sporting facilities, Eckerd College, University of Florida, all sorts of places. I was at MIT recently, and there was George M. Steinbrenner Field. His father had gone to MIT. George has done a lot of good for a lot of people.
Age and disease have robbed George Steinbrenner of his energy and taken him away from the daily business of running the Yankees. Do you have any sense of how he's doing these days?
From what I understand, he has both dementia and Alzheimer's, and it's very serious. I went to the last game at the old Yankee Stadium last year, and it was a marvelous, marvelous ceremony, and he wasn't there. And I thought that was very sad. I mean, here's this guy. He came from Cleveland, but in no time he became, you know, the biggest thing in sports in New York. He was the Yankees, and for him not to be at that closing ceremony, I just thought was very, very sad.
Do you feel that the Yankees are in better shape in the hands of George Steinbrenner's sons than they were when the boss at his full capacity was in charge?
I do. The two boys are really terrific people, and they do not have narcissism. They're people who respect their employees, and they'll let their general manager do the job, let their manager do the job. And I can tell you this because early in the season, Cleveland came to the new Yankee Stadium and beat the Yankees 22-4. And I am convinced that if George Steinbrenner had been there, that Joe Girardi would have been fired right after that game.
Peter Golenbach is the author of George, the Poor Little Rich Boy Who Built the Yankee Empire, published by Wiley. He joined me from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Peter, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Always.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. The story in last week's program about the Clericus Cup, a soccer tournament involving priests and seminarians and set on the Vatican's own pitch, moved one listener to leave us a voicemail.
Listening to the Albany station for Only a Game, and I wanted to ask if you could please tell me the title of the CD that was played at the very end of the program. Thanks very much.
Why that listener preferred to remain anonymous is a mystery, but the song was God's Footballer by Billy Bragg.
God's footballer turns on a sixpence and brings the great crowd to their feet in praise of him. God's footballer quotes from the Gospels while knocking on doors in the black country back streets. He scores goals on a Saturday and saves souls on a Sunday.
The game the rest of the world calls football has inspired other artists as well. When she wanted to express her dismay at men who lead women on, Kirsty MacColl plunked her narrator down in a London pub to watch a match on TV and compare herself to the lads on the losing side.
You lied about your status, you lied about your life. You never mentioned your three children and the fact you have a wife.
In England, the fame of the footballers overflows the players and floats the careers, or at least the personas, of the women in their lives, who are referred to in the British press as WAGs, short for wives and girlfriends. Among same is Victoria Posh Beckham, so perhaps it was Posh, whom Scottish singer-songwriter Amy MacDonald had in mind when she came up with The Footballer's Wife, a sly dig at people celebrated for being famous.
But the tells her troubles and strife. I just don't care in the end. Who is she to pretend that she's one of them? I don't think so.
So many songs, so little time, and I haven't even begun to receive any of the anthems and ballads sure to have been inspired by FC Barcelona's 2-0 win over Manchester United in Wednesday's Champions League final. They'll come, I'm sure.
I don't think so. Oh, Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire, won't you dance for me? 'Cause I just don't care what's going on today. I think there's something more. Something more.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Decordova Museum and Sculpture Park, presenting modern and contemporary sculpture and art on 35 acres, 15 miles from Boston in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Details at decordova.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you're in a casino anytime soon and you notice a woman named Patricia DeMoro throwing dice, you might want to shoulder your way to her table and bet everything that she'll continue to do so indefinitely. On Saturday at the Borgata Hotel Casino in Atlantic City, Ms. DeMoro set a new record for the longest craps roll ever, hanging onto the dice for 4 hours and 18 minutes. Ms. DeMoro bought into the game for $100 and rolled the dice 154 times. Fairly shortly after it became apparent that she might never lose, a large crowd gathered to cheer her on. The casino would not reveal how much she had won, and apparently, cognizant of the tax laws, Ms. DeMoro wasn't saying either.
Luck, let a gentleman see just how nice a dame you can be.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, axe throwing and vertical chopping for the old alma mater. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Cleveland Cavaliers avoided elimination on Thursday night, but they still need to beat the Orlando Magic twice in a row to attain their rightful place in the NBA Finals, unless rightful is no longer the appropriate adjective. What do you think?
I think they've got a chance, but not a very good one, and I don't think rightful is the adjective anymore. I think Orlando, you know, who spent most of the season, as we say, with the mental car radio on scan, has fastened on a very strong station at this point. Although their inability to play coming out of the locker room at halftime is completely inexplicable to me.
Since you and I last spoke, two teams have advanced to the National Hockey League Finals. Any surprise on your part that they are the Detroit Red Wings and the Pittsburgh Penguins?
No. In fact, as much as I wanted to see a Detroit-Boston or a Chicago-Boston Original Six final, there's no question that Pittsburgh is playing the best hockey in the league right now. You've got real star power against the presiding dynasty of the last 15 years. So there's a very good opportunity for the NHL to sell its product again.
Game one of the finals takes place tonight in Detroit. You want to make a pick?
I think Detroit will win the first game. I think Pittsburgh is not prepared for what they're going to get, the flying octopi and everything else. I think Detroit will get the first one at home for the fans.
Charlie, it's usually no surprise when an effective 6 foot 10 inch shot blocker earns a basketball scholarship to a Division I school, but Kevin Lau played his way onto the Manhattan College roster despite the fact that he's missing half of his left arm. Quite an accomplishment, don't you think?
I think it's a terrific story. I mean, Manhattan plays at a really high level. He's got a chance to be in the tournament a couple of times while he's there. I think it's really wonderful, and it's proof of the coaching adage that you can't coach height. The guy is tall enough, and he can block shots. And if they put enough players around him, it'll be a very, very good story down the line.
Just as former head coach John Calipari's limo disappears over the horizon, the Memphis program that he left behind in order to take a job at Kentucky is being investigated by the NCAA for, quote, knowing fraudulence and misconduct. Surely there's been some sort of misunderstanding.
Is it time for Louis Reyno? Of course it is. I'm shocked, shocked to learn that this will happen. Now, if this goes through and Memphis's appearance in 2008 Final Four is vacated, as they say in the NCAA record book, this will be a remarkable parlay. Memphis will have made two Final Fours since 1985, both of which will have been vacated. John Calipari will have made two Final Fours since 1990, both of which have been vacated.
Okay, quiz time. What Major League Baseball event, likely never to be duplicated, transpired 50 years ago this week?
Well, see, I'm cheating a little bit because this is one of the big moments in Milwaukee sports history, too.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey Haddix pitched a perfect game against the former Milwaukee Braves for 12 innings, I believe.
All I can think of is he must have been thinking, what do I have to do to win this game? Because he lost.
Well, considering that you can't get most starting pitchers to pitch 12 innings in a week these days, I mean, this is quite a remarkable deal.
It has taken Randy Johnson 22 seasons in the big leagues, but as of Tuesday night, he has moved to within one victory of the 300-win mark. He's currently employed by the San Francisco Giants, though, so what are the odds that he gets number 300 before the 4th of July?
Well, I was going to say Labor Day, actually, but I think by the end of the year when they're trying to put people in the building out there, I think it's probably a good one to have him still going for 300. 300 is as devalued as the home run numbers have been, as 500 home runs have been, or even 600 home runs now, 300 wins is still the gold standard. That's a remarkable accomplishment because nobody wins that many games anymore.
Well, for the record, he would be tied for 23rd with Lefty Grove and Early Win, so pretty good company.
Yes, two guys from the Pleistocene era, I would point out.
Not Early Win. I remember him. Come on. Manny Ramirez of the Dodgers is currently serving a 50-game suspension, having tested positive for a banned substance. Still, as of Tuesday, he had garnered over 440,000 fan votes for the 2009 All-Star Game. I had no idea 440,000 baseball fans could be so forgiving.
It's terrific, isn't it? It's one of these things where I think that maybe the player was, like, organizing the thing on his behalf, but then he gets Manny and can't organize anything.
No.
So, I mean, I think this is a spontaneous outpouring of love.
Much to my delight, FC Barcelona beat Manchester United in the Champions League final on Wednesday, Charlie. Academics at the University of Leicester had published a report to coincide with that game, which concluded that more than 2 million motorists have had an accident or near miss while listening to soccer matches on the radio. I don't suppose there'd be any problem if they banned listening to soccer on the radio in the UK, do you?
Well, I think that we have to differentiate from ordinary people listening to soccer on the radio and listening to the radio soccer hooligans who deliberately drive their cars into things.
Having been less than entirely successful as a celebrity boxer, Jose Canseco tried mixed martial arts on Monday night. How'd that go?
Well, he ran into a 7-foot-tall Korean who made him about 4'11" in the ring. I think your question went a few words too far. Jose Canseco's job now is to be a celebrity. I mean, it turns out he's to be a celebrity punching bag at this point. But I have a feeling that there aren't any more places for him to go unless he's, you know, prepared to be a crash test dummy or something.
After having won last weekend's World Beard and Mustache Championships in Anchorage, Alaska, David Traver vowed to shave his woven, multicolored beard for the highest bidder and to donate the proceeds to charity. And he added that he was retiring because he has reached the apex and, quote, you can't go any higher. You can't argue with that assessment, right?
No, I think once you've won the World Beard and Mustache Championship, I mean, where can you go beard and mustache-wise? You can't exactly go on a circuit, can you?
GoPro.
If mine gets a little grayer, I'm going to join the Veterans Tour.
Excellent.
Me and a bunch of Old Testament prophets.
And finally, Charlie, say your Jonathan Lee Riches, a.k.a. Johnny Tsunami, a.k.a. Lawsuit Zeus, and the Guinness Book of World Records announces that you are going to be listed as the most litigious man in history, and you don't want them to do that. What do you do?
Well, see, I want to make it clear to Johnny, if he's listening to the program, that this is Bill asking me this, and I'm not doing this on my own, because I don't need any trouble. You sue them, of course.
And he did.
The really interesting thing is he sued people like Britney Spears.
Oh, yeah.
I think he sued an entire state at one point.
No one's safe.
It's hard to believe the guy's not an agent.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. And his new book, Idiot America, will be in the stores next week. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Dartmouth College was founded in 1769 and built in a place once called the Royal Province of New Hampshire. Its charter was provided by King George III of England. Today, New Hampshire is no longer a colony, at least as far as I know, and Dartmouth is a member of the Ivy League, but some things never change. From Hanover, New Hampshire, Only a Game's Karen Given reports on a collegiate endeavor that brings back crosscut saws, large metal axes, and lots of lumber.
The 63rd annual Woodsman's Weekend at Dartmouth College starts as one might expect, with Bernie Law, class of 74, playing the national anthem on a saw. The crowd stifles giggles as Bernie struggles for the right notes on a saw that's, in Bernie's words, quite sharp. More than 200 competitors made it to the Hanover Green for the 8 a.m. start, including 100 Dartmouth College alumni celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Dartmouth Outing Club.
Competitors ready. Timer's ready. 3, 2, 1, go.
Come on, get into the field.
There's never a lack of action at the Woodsman's Weekend. While the single buck competition runs on the southeast corner of the green, the chopping, axe throw, and obstacle course events take over the center. Fly casting and the chain throw occupy the northwest corner. And to the west, head judge Jim Pork Roll Taylor, Dartmouth class of 74, teaches the crowd how to cheer for birling. Pork Roll suggests spectators might want to try tiny steps or wave your arms when encouraging burlers balanced atop a log floating in a makeshift pond. But most of the time, the event is over too quickly for the crowd to say much at all.
Tiny steps.
Go!
Woo!
Earl Jetty, Dartmouth's Emeritus Director of Outdoor Programs, says the Woodsman's Weekend dates back to the days of Ross McKenney, who wanted to teach outdoor skills to the men of Dartmouth.
He realized after a few years that they needed to have something more than just learning the skill. They needed to have some goal. And so he and a guy by the name of Bill Robes, who taught at Kimball Union Academy, they decided that they would have an event, a competition. So they had a competition between the two schools in 46, and it went so well that they said, we got to build this up. This is a great thing to do.
These days, Dartmouth is co-ed, and so is the Woodsman's Weekend. Schools like Harvard and MIT have dropped out and been replaced by names like Sir Sanford Fleming College from Peterborough, Ontario, and SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry from Wanakena, New York. And since nearly no one comes to college with woodsman's skills these days, Earl Jetty has a lot to teach.
I never get over the feeling of watching them when they're here as first-year students and don't know which end of the axe to use, and then 4 years later, they're winning.
Dartmouth junior Alex Perez Lawrence is the women's team captain and one of the meet directors for the weekend. She certainly remembers her first team practice.
I think that was the first time I ever really held a chopping axe. But, I mean, it's so much fun because I'm a small person, so
for me, I feel very strong when I'm holding an axe. Nobody's going to mess with me.
It's true. Alex is one of the smallest competitors on the green, her petite frame dwarfed by the burly physiques of most of her male and female competition. But don't think Alex takes the easy way out when practicing her favorite sport.
We fell our own trees to practice on because we need wood to practice, and we buck them up, we carry them all to our practice area, peel them, prepare them for chopping or sawing, and then just go at it.
Rory Goller is Dartmouth's staff advisor to the Woodsman's team, and he doesn't see anything unusual about a prestigious Ivy League college hosting a lumberjacking competition.
On the exterior, it looks a little bit silly to cut down a lot of trees and smash them into unusable bits, but I think that a lot of the people who do this, whether they're forestry students looking at a career in forest management or liberal arts students who are looking at a career potentially in politics, really gives you a sense of stewardship of the outdoors.
Folks like Rory are trying to get the Woodsman's team recognized as an official sport at Dartmouth. That's not a problem at places like Finger Lakes Community College and Paul Smith's College, both in upstate New York, where lumberjacking isn't just a sport, it's the sport.
I think for some of these schools, it may be the only sports team they have. You know, you got the College of Forestry and Land Management. This is their football team. You know, this is what they put everything towards. Some of these teams go dry for the season. A lot of the people take it really seriously.
Finger Lakes Community College woodsmen cheer their teammates on to a second-place finish in the horizontal chop. Brian Harrison agrees with the assessment that woodsman's is more important than football at his school.
Yeah, seeing that we don't have a football team, it's a big deal for us. It's the team that's won the most championships, and we're pretty prestigious at school.
And any idea how many championships that is?
Somebody help me out. 14? 15? 15, including last year. We're defending champions right now.
Megan Beely, Ali Sikora, and Jackie June from Paul Smith's College say the same is true at their school.
A lot of people said they didn't have football at our school, so they do woodsman's or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, plus it's co-ed.
Exactly. And they get girls. You can't complain.
The women of Paul Smith's pull their hair back in pigtails and jazz up their brown team uniforms with rainbow suspenders. But they take this sport just as seriously as the men do.
We've creeped up behind the guys. They've trained us well, and we're hoping to keep a good name for ourselves now.
It's a sport. It really is. We try to do about 3 times a week for about 2-3 hours each, and then any off time we got, any personal training, going to the gym if we want, going to the pool, the canoe, Jackie Burrell's in the pool.
Yeah, that was always a good time, purling.
Oh, man. Wait, do people look at you strange when you want to put a log in the pool?
Not at our school, really. I think that this kind of stuff is acceptable at this point.
Go, Max! Go, Max!
Go, Max!
Slow.
Yeah!
Dartmouth's Max Bogren splits a biscuit on the obstacle course while his mom, Betsy, cheers him on. Betsy came all the way from Fairbanks, Alaska to see her son compete today. But that doesn't mean she's happy about how he's spending his free time at school.
In high school, he was a springboard diver, and I thought, oh, God, that's a high-risk sport. He moves on to college and does this. You know, when you watch the chopping events, you go, what in the world are they doing? You know, yeah, standing on a log and swinging a heavy, sharp object towards your legs. So as a mom, you kind of close your eyes and say, nice job. That's your only choice.
After he graduates this spring, Max will have to find another way to make his mom cringe. The skills tested during the Woodsman's Weekend don't have much use in the modern world. If he's lucky, though, he'll be like Putt Blodgett, Dartmouth class of 53, who, despite being well into his 70s, still competes once a year on Dartmouth's alumni team. And he's always looking for more teammates.
Oh, yes. This is an event that generates a tremendous amount of camaraderie and a common interest. Dartmouth didn't graduate women until 1976, so there's only 4 or 5 classes to choose from, and yet we have these over 50 women. One of them came from San Francisco, one of them from Boise, Idaho, and I tried to insult enough of the under 50 alums to make them mad enough to show up, and I think I succeeded.
When putts over 50 men climb on top of their logs for the three-person horizontal chop, the last event of the weekend, the PA announcer lets the crowd know that 175 years of combined woodsman's experience has lined up on the green. No one seems to mind that the old farts, as they call themselves, are still chopping long after everyone else is finished. In fact, as the current and alumni Dartmouth teammates gather for a photo and a song, no one seems to mind that not one of the Dartmouth teams is in contention for a trophy. The men and women of Dartmouth seem to feel pretty strong anyway.
And the credit of New Hampshire in their muscles and their brains. And the credit of New Hampshire in their muscles and their brains.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurz. And we had help this week from Dustin Hapley at WUSF in Tampa. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's lumberjacking photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Lumber Jill Jackie June. That just trips right off the tongue. Anyway, she is also a culinary major at Paul Smith's College.
Oh, yeah. I can cut vegetables and use a chainsaw. It's pretty good.
Yeah, Jackie, I bet you only use that chainsaw when it's a really big carrot. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.